Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
Doing fantastic today, Tim. After we spoke with our guest, we became a little bit smarter, a little bit more aware of crime and crime prevention. Hope everyone out there is doing just as well as I'm doing. And Tim, I don't want to prevent you from telling us how you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you. I am doing great here today. Thanks a lot for asking. And yeah, we have a fantastic guest today. His name is Michael Arntfield, and he is from Canada, and he's written books, and he's on TV, and he spent about an hour with us. He also is on the board of directors at the Murder Accountability Project, and you can check out what they're doing at murderdata.org. It's already been a resource that we have used here at Crawlspace Media for years. Make sure to check that out, but also check out his books. We speak a little bit about one of his books called Murder City. We also speak about his latest book, How to Solve a Cold Case, which I'm currently listening to, and it's great so far, Lance.
He really is a great writer, and although he is a criminologist, a professor at the University of Western Ontario, a London police officer for 15 years where he served as an officer and a detective, he's been utilized as an expert on numerous networks including the Peacock Network, ID Discovery, A&E, HBO, the Oxygen Network, the list goes on and on. And I have to say, I was a little surprised at how intimidated he was by us. It took a little while for him to get the jitters out, I feel.
Well, I'm not sure if you're... That wasn't the read I had on it.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, he is great. Make sure you check out his books, and I hope you you really enjoy this conversation with Mr. Michael Arntfield.
And before we get to Michael, we're going to take a quick break for our sponsors. Stick around.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of The Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to The Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
New England is known for its charming towns, comforting foods, and of course, its historical contributions, but the Down East region can have a dark side. I'm investigative journalist Kylie Lowe, and on my weekly podcast, Dark Down East, I dig into both decades-old and modern-day cases from my home state of Maine and the greater New England area. In each episode of Dark Down East, I seek insight from law enforcement officials, family members, and other loved ones who are both deeply familiar with the cases and the individuals at the heart of them. Join me as I unveil intricacies of these stories that are often overlooked, honor the grit of those searching for justice, and shine a light on cases that you aren't hearing on other podcasts. Listen to Dark Down East now, wherever you're listening.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program. Welcome to the podcast, author Michael Arntfield. How are you today?
Good. Good to see you guys. Glad we could make this work out.
Yeah, for sure. We had reached out to you a few weeks ago, and you were busy, and you said circle back. And for the first time in my life, I paid attention to a notification that I had set weeks ago to circle back with you. You're traveling. You took time out of your day to join us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And for those who don't know who you are, would you mind giving a little bit of your background.
Okay, so I was a police officer and detective in Canada for just over 15 years, during which time I got a PhD in criminology and published some research. I'm now a tenured professor at Western University. I've published 12 books and several dozen peer-reviewed journal articles and encyclopedias. I'm on TV fairly regularly, Discovery ID, Oxygen, Peacock, the NBC streamer. Regarding some true crime series, I'm a director of the Murder Accountability Project in Washington, D.C., which is absolutely fascinating work we're doing. Your listeners can check it out at murderdata.org. We built the most comprehensive homicide data set in North America. It is publicly searchable for researchers and for investigators. I've got my own podcast called Suspect Zero. I co-host with a true crime teacher in the U.S. there, and I have some other stuff sort of on the go. That's sort of the short version, boys.
This is exactly what I was talking about, because an article popped up sort of on my news cycle, I guess, where it mentioned the serial killer capital of the world, which was in Canada. And you wrote the book Murder City, which is about this. But then you find out about the Murder Accountability Project, which has been a resource for us and some of our colleagues for a long time. So just those two things alone, just super impressive.
Yeah, thanks. We're very proud of, I'm proud of both accomplishments, but the Murder Accountability Project is really absolutely extraordinary. And what we've been able to do, in fact, to tie all this sort of together, cold cases, murder data, big data projects, is we got the bipartisan buy-in of both Republican and Democratic Congress people during Trump's time in office. And we lobbied them to table a bill, a bipartisan bill called the Homicide Victims Families Rights Act, which sort of died on the floor and dies with each sort of presidential administration, but has since been revivified under Biden and is now passed into federal law in the United States, whereby if a case goes cold for the prescribed period, the families of the victims, they're not getting anywhere with law enforcement, can bring a motion in court to have law enforcement by judge's order open up the files of that case to an approved third-party agency, whether that be an investigative journalist, whether that be a sanctioned group like the VDOC Society or the N8 group in the UK, or the Murder Accountability Project for that matter. So this opens a new lane of accountability and I think dialogue with stakeholders, broadly defined, because as we've seen at Murder Accountability, or MAP as we call it, I mean, some of these cities have cases, dozens of connected cases, presumptively connected cases that have seen no action in years, if not decades. So it's time that, you know, somebody else get a crack at these.
Where does your inspiration to do this come from?
I guess it goes back to being a cop and not liking things unresolved. Obviously, I took an interest in the cold cases in the London, Ontario, in Canada region, where I was a police officer. And during the early portions of my career, there was a cold case task force underway that really sort of let the rank and file know about what had happened in the past. And these are the cases ultimately tabulated in Murder City. But it wasn't for another 15 years before I got access to all of the real sort of primary source materials, which were the original investigators from the 60s and 70s notes, and stuff that presumably was available to the original investigators on this task force, but which had never really been consolidated in one place before, subjected to sort of the analysis that I put it through from a criminological perspective, knowing that a lot of these offenders who weren't caught are presumed dead or known to be dead, and that there won't be any official closure in the traditional sense in terms of an arrest announced, but that there can still be answers. And ultimately, that's what we're seeing more and more people want, is just sort of an answer, not necessarily a day in court.
And with your work, I guess, across the borders between the United States and Canada, what are some of the differences in how an investigation is run between the two nations?
Great question. So the adequacy standards, at least on paper, are largely identical between both Canada and the U.S. Both Canada and the U.S. until recently, I've relied on what's known as the Uniform Crime Reporting, or UCR, system, which is a standard fixed choice menu of basically how to walk police through an investigation. These are the things you're looking for. These are the things you have to report back to the government. In Canada, it's required. In the U.S., it's discretionary. So we see only about half of the departments have been reporting. And that's what we do at MAP, is go out and then find the missing annual homicide reports. That's changing a bit. Many U.S. agencies are moving to a more sophisticated system known as National Incident-Based Reporting, which is going to create some problems. And both Canada and the U.S. are hobbled by the same issues that leave a lot of cases. In fact, in 2020, records set in both countries in terms of the total number of unresolved or uncleared homicides. In the U.S., it's a coin toss. Just a little over 50% nationally are solved or cleared. And I don't mean someone convicted and incarcerated. I mean a suspect even ever identified. In Canada, it's a little bit better. We don't have as many homicides. Some cities have close to as many per capita, but we're around sort of 65%. The main difference between the two is in the U.S., and you guys are investigators and journalists, you'll know this, freedom of information legislation is taken seriously. This is what we rely on at Murder Accountability to get access to these records. In Canada, it's a big joke. They'll find a way to deny access to this information, even to homicide scholars such as myself. So I've tried to build a Murder Accountability Project Canada, and I've tried to scrape some of the basic granular level case information that you see in the hundreds of thousands at murderdata.org. And I've been denied outright under the pretext that even though all of these murders are stripped of identifying information, that if I were to publish or make available all these tens of thousands of murders, somebody could hunt and peck and based on the date and based on the cause of death, go and identify who the victim was. And therefore, by publishing that or allowing that to be published, the federal government is breaching that decedent's or that murder victim's privacy, if you can believe that nonsense. So this is what we're dealing with up here. It's pushing a boulder up a hill just to try to get some public accountability. Whereas in the US, good or bad or otherwise, you can't hide these investigative steps or missteps that police take. And it's for that reason that we're able to build out this massive resource.
That's a huge undertaking. And Tim asked a question that mine is going to be a little bit similar, but I'm going to go further back in your past. He said, what, I guess, to the effect of what's your drive? And you had said that being a police officer, you don't like seeing things unresolved. Was there something that happened even further back in your life that was unresolved that you put into your work?
Well, there's sort of a multiplicity of things interacting. So before I was a police officer, as a child, one of the cases that ended up being the subject of that task force in the late 90s, and then ultimately one of the key cases I examined in Murder City, was the kidnapping and murder of a 9-year-old boy in the neighborhood where I grew up, and it was never solved. Is before my time, but I walked the same path to school as he took. We went to different schools, but in a weird set of logistics, I had to walk to his school to catch a bus to my school because it was there was limited enrollment in the school. So I had to walk to the school he went to and walked his same path because he lived would have been my neighbor. So this became a local boogeyman story in an otherwise pretty sedate, middle class, Canadian Main Street neighborhood and classic suburbia. And the fact that he was never caught led obviously every family and every kid to wonder, is this person still out there? Are they still living in the neighborhood? It was ultimately years later that I realized, in fact, he moved out shortly after that, but he had other victims, not in that immediate area, but there was little question who did it. And this information now was made available by dint of these notes, whereby his name was never publicly released, but he was doggedly pursued by the lead investigator in the 60s through to the early 70s and ultimately left town to shake this guy off. And now we see that there's other victims in the city where he moved next that maybe they're linked to him, maybe not, but certainly the MO matches. And this is all information that would have been nice to know years earlier, obviously, but such is the nature of cold cases, in that they take on a life of their own and a certain lore of their own when people aren't provided with any information, including, and we're seeing this more and more, especially with cold cases. Police aren't necessarily releasing the name of the offender, but they'll at least allay the public and say the person of interest in these cases, XYZ, is now deceased. So you can rest easy, which is a bit of a cryptic way of doing it. But I can think off the top of my head three cases in the last sort of 24 months that have used that way of trying to assure the public without compromising the sort of secrecy and integrity of the investigation.
Why aren't more cases solved?
Yeah, great question. So if you look at the graph at murderdata.org, you can look at, since the implementation of the Uniform Crime Reporting System in 1929, it has been the clearance rate, as we call it, has been steadily declining. And then there's a couple of years where it drops off a cliff. So, I mean, the decline is precipitous, but is consistent. And then all of a sudden, it's very sharp. 2016 was a key year. 2020 was another key year. And nobody really knows why. I mean, some cynics would say, well, a lot of these clearances back in the 40s and 50s were probably wrongfully accused people or what have, or there were fewer murders, so they were solving more of them. The latter may be true. I mean, are these all accounted for by bad clearances, by wrongful convictions? I very much doubt that. The difference between then and now is we see that murder just isn't a priority for many law enforcement agencies out of necessity. I mean, I'm not going to advertise some of these cities, but when you have, 18 shootings a weekend, last week's case goes cold pretty quickly. And we see that a lot of major cities are actually dragging down the overall national average. So the national average in the U.S. is a little better than 50%. But I mean, some cities is 28, 30%. So 3 in 10 get solved. 7 in 10 killers never end up on police radar. So that has a cumulative effect coast to coast when you've got major cities clocking those types of poor numbers. Another theory that's been floated is, beyond the fact that there's not a lot of resources, and not a lot of cooperation, quite frankly, in some communities with police, is that there's become an over-reliance on forensic methodologies like DNA, to the extent that traditional sort of shoe leather police techniques, knocking on doors, interviewing people, assembling circumstantial cases, which is how cases got solved for most of modern police work, that those skills have been numbed. And in, unless there's a ballistics hit or a DNA hit, they sort of are out of their depth, and they'll just sort of put it on a shelf and wait for a match to come back from the lab one day. And in the meantime, work the low-hanging fruit cases, which are the ones with DNA. And in the meantime, you've got all these ones accumulating. So it's an interesting theory to consider.
On the Murder Accountability Project website, there is a link for murder clusters. Can you unpack that for us a little bit? What is a murder cluster?
So great question. So we've got, give or take, 750,000 homicides in the data bank. We're in the midst of getting further previously never reported murders from the federal government that has been in violation of its own law since 1989. So the NCIS, the FBI, the Department of the Interior, which looks after Bureau of Indian Affairs and the National Park Service, none of these agencies have ever reported the murders they investigate back to themselves or back to the federal government. So we're getting that now. So our database will grow significantly. But what we've done for now, and we will continue to do, is we've built an algorithm that essentially looks for commonalities in MO between two or more uncleared homicides in a census metropolitan area. So that could include a county or a city, again, the mega city, the census metropolitan area. And it relies on a number of points of analysis that simulates what's known as the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program, which is a much larger, complex system used by the FBI to track patterns or linkages in murders between states. We don't have the ability to look coast to coast and match a potential case in Maine to a case in New Mexico, but we can look as large, as wide as a specific county. And these clusters are two or more open homicides that have compelling linkages as identified through our software. And there's some notable ones. We alert police agencies in these areas of the existence of the cluster, and we've had mixed results. There's a task force in Chicago right now. It's the subject of a documentary on ID called The Hunt for the Chicago Strangler, looking into 51 connected strangulation murders since 2000 that our software identified. We identified two other patterns in Cleveland, Ohio, that, again, action to task force led to an arrest. Only one charge was ever laid, a brutal charge, but we're satisfied this individual is responsible for many more crimes, and they've since stopped. In Gary, Indiana, which was the first cluster identified, they largely ignored the pleas of our chairman, Tom Hargrove, outright. Said, you know, we don't have a serial killer problem. This is junk science. And then lo and behold, a short time later, Darren Dion Van was arrested in a neighboring community and confessed to all the murders, or most of the murders, in Gary, Indiana, identified by our software, and took police around to where the bodies were located of other cases, or showed them what he had done. And again, it's consistent with what we had found. So had they listened to us, and mind you, this is the first example of the algorithm being used in real time, you know, several other women likely, including his final victim, who was murdered in a neighboring community of Hammond, Illinois, would still be alive today.
Wow. And how many murders make a cluster?
Two or more. So that's consistent with the accepted definition of serial homicide, which is two or more victims in separate occurrences at separate times and places. The FBI's official definition still is three or more, and that's in U.S. code, largely to justify bringing them in. Again, most investigators, so that's a bureaucratic definition, whereas an operational and a criminological definition is two or more. You don't need to wait for the third for a pattern to be deemed to be established.
Right. So if I'm looking at the map and there's a cluster of, say, like five or six unsolved, it looks like it's fair to say that there's a killer there, or there could be.
So this is part of what presumptively compelling, to the extent that what my students now do in my cold case research group at Western is, because the algorithm is only dealing with basic zeros and ones. It's just data. It's just looking for what has been recorded by police in terms of weapon use, in terms of age of the victim, in terms of potential motive. So my students then will go and find more qualitative data to either screen that in as a confirmed set of linkages, or a false positive, screen it out. So we'll go and we'll pull media reports. We'll find out if in fact what's been reported to the Justice Department by the police agency in question is accurate. Because there is some inaccuracies. We see a lot of inaccuracies in terms of coding the ethnicity of the victim, for instance. We see a lot of inaccuracies in terms of weapon or cause of death, even, or what we call manner of death. So cause of death could be any number of obviously sources of trauma, but manner of death is either homicide, suicide, accident, natural, or undetermined. So we'll see a lot of undetermineds, meaning police, coroner, or medical examiner aren't really sure, that should probably have been reported as homicides. And that's a whole other issue entirely that we track, which is concealed or missing murders, of which there's about 2,500 a year in the U.S.
Wow. Really interesting stuff. And I guess, how do you enter things to the algorithm? Do you have, like, there's like 10 markers or something that you upload from articles?
Not from articles, directly from Uniform Crime reports to which contain all that information. It has to contain ethnicity of the victim, age of the victim, weapon, motive if known or suspected, date, gender, obviously. So that's what we have to work with. Violent Crime Criminal Apprehension Program, or VICAP, has 300 and something points. So they get a lot of missed, and just filling out those forms among law enforcement is onerous, to the point many just don't do it. So there's blind spots all over the country. Our philosophy is you don't need 300 data points. You need about six to at least get the ball rolling. I mean, VICAP gets into very esoteric details that, quite frankly, most detectives don't have the experience or training to even properly identify in the form. So, I mean, our objective is keep it simple, cast a wider net. Are we going to get some false positives? Yes. Do we have the resources to begin screening out those false positives and at least drilling down into the ones that look like Chicago, that are largely irrefutable? Absolutely. Because VICAP didn't identify Chicago. We identified Chicago.
And when do you sleep?
Yeah, while I'm driving. I shouldn't say that. No.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Rex Sherman is a demon that walks among us, a predator that ruined families.
The LISK, Long Island Serial Killer Podcast, was shocked when the news broke of Rex Huerman's arrest. After more than a decade of searching, law enforcement officials had finally pieced together enough evidence to bring formal charges against Rex Huerman. Initially charged with 3 murders, Huerman is now officially charged with all 4 deaths in the Gilgo 4 case. I'm your host, Chris Moss, and the LISK Podcast will be releasing new episodes with interviews and fresh insight on the case as Rex Huerman awaits trial in Long Island. While we are relieved by the arrest, the LISK podcast team will be working hard to share new developments and perspectives as we get them. So please keep your eyes and ears out for new episodes, and if you haven't already, please listen to seasons 1 and 2 of LISK, Long Island Serial Killer, wherever you listen to podcasts.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Do you find yourself captivated by the inexplicable, entranced by enigmas, and tantalized by the unknown? We are Shane and Josh Waters, brothers who will weave you through tales that have mystified us for years. From haunted hotels to inexplicable disappearances,
our episodes offer you a panoramic view of the world's greatest mysteries, leaving no stone unturned, no clue unnoticed.
With a gripping narrative, we invite you to join us on a journey into realms of the unexplained.
We're unraveling the mysteries that have perplexed humanity for ages.
So, armchair detectives, curious minds, and seekers of the strange, it's time to put on your headphones and dim the lights.
Dive into the uncanny world of the Mystery Inc. podcast and prepare for a journey into the unknown that you'll never forget. And remember, some mysteries are better left unsolved, but not unexplored.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program.
But okay, let's talk about London, Ontario. And you've written a number of books, and one of your books is called Murder City, and it is about London, Ontario. What is it about this place that has made it sort of renowned as the serial killer capital of the world?
Well, it's not really renowned. I stumbled across that again once I started putting together the original source materials provided to me by the son of the deceased detective, who basically left them as a time capsule and said, like, I don't have the resources. I don't know what we were dealing with back then, but someday somebody will. And they made their way to me, and I synthesized all this data and compared everything. And many of these crimes that I knew had happened, I'd heard about them as a cop, they turn out to have been investigated as sexual homicides in the work of a serial killer. And that never really was made public. And once you start tabulating all of these and siloing them off by either a known offender, incarcerated, convicted offender, or suspected linkages to an unsub, but still at large, you basically got 9 separate offenders operating in a bedroom community of 100,000 people. In many cases, concurrently, in some cases consecutively, but at any given time, the serial killer to civilian population is per capita greater than any other city that I can find, at least in the G7 that keeps reliable data. So based on the available data, there's just no refuting that for 25 years, this otherwise unremarkable, what they called the Forest City, had a major serial killer problem. And there's all kinds of theories as to why. It sort of was the ideal operating ground for serial offenders for a number of reasons. One, it was one of the first outpost cities, first main sort of destination cities along the main highway system in much of urban Canada. which predates the U.S. interstate system by 4 years. And we know the drastic effect that interstate offending has had on communities and how serial killers have exploited the U.S. interstate to the extent that there's an FBI task force still looking at that. Well, we were living that reality years earlier than Americans. This is the one area where Canadians were actually ahead of the curve, ahead of Americans in terms of developing this type of infrastructure. And with that came sexual deviants who were marooned in weird rural counties all over the place, now able to come to a city with a stock pond of victims, a college, a university, many young people, a fall fair, all kinds of what we call crime attractors for motivated serial offenders. The other variables include the fact that it was a city where nobody wanted to talk about what actually happened there. It was the hubris and I guess pride of the city was impregnable, and no one was prepared to talk about what the school principal was up to, what happens at this particular church, what happens at this particular variety store, the Stanley Variety, which is discussed in the book. I mean, it was essentially a dead letter drop for child pornography. They would assemble there for screenings of underage exploited films exploiting children. So it's not a surprise that one of the teenage clerks there ends up murdered in a very ritualistic fashion by somebody drawn there, because they weren't really relying on confections and cigarettes to sell. It was a cover for something else. So, but nobody wanted to talk about that. And the third reason is, and it may just be an interesting coincidence, but London was one of Canada's two first consumer test market cities. So a lot of products actually that even Americans take for granted now, certain coffee blends, ATM banking, failed brands at major fast food outlets were beta tested in London, because demographers and advertisers knew that the city was so, there was such what we call demographic segmentation in the city. X number of retirees, X number of people on social assistance, X number of people who are students, X number of people who are affluent, X number of people who are passing through. And they realized that the city was a microcosm of their entire target market, and that there was very little cross-pollination between these groups because of that siloed effect of the city. So if you wanted to test a weird, again, sandwich at a fast food outlet, London would be the place to do it, because if you could make it there, any market in the country would work. So it's just a weird coincidence that you have London as a destination city for demographers and advertisers to test new products because of its social balkanization, you could call it. And for the same reason, serial killers thrive in that environment. The two have to be correlated.
It's incredibly fascinating. And when you are looking into this and you make the decision that you're going to write a book and do a lot of research on it, this is a 25-year period from 1959 to 1984. So who's the first person someone like yourself will reach out to get the most accurate information possible?
When you have, again, primary source material, so talking to people is what we would call from a research perspective, unless this is somebody who's lived experience, so they're a direct eyewitness, they're typically secondary sources, people who have heard things, people who have done their own research and have insight, but they're not the original unfettered source material. In this case, the original true primary source, Dennis Alsop, the detective who shouldered most of these 29 murder cases in one way or another, is deceased. So the next best thing are his contemporaneous notes, as we say, his diary entries, his duty book logs, his teletypes to other police agencies asking for help, reports that drawn up for the senior brass asking for more time and detailing who all the killers are. And who all the victims are and how they're connected, using, again, the limited terminology of the time. This is before we understood really even what made these people tick. But he's grappling with the best clinical language that he can to try to raise the alarm with his superiors that this is not just business as usual. These are not just personal cause homicides. They've got what to use his words, a sexual psychopath, which to see that show up in a police report in 1968 is like 20 years ahead of its time. And it's interesting. So he's talking to the right people. And these are some of the people who were living that I would then follow up with, one of whom, unfortunately, is not still alive. And I would have liked to talk to, was a professor of theology at the university where I am now, who was deemed in the day to be something of an expert on occultism I guess demonology. And he was consulted, if you can imagine this today, by a senior police detective, because of the ritual nature of some of these child murders, asking, showing him photos, saying, like, are we dealing with a satanic cult in London? Is there a disordered sort of black mass sacrificial nature to some of these crimes? Because they were highly ritual and hadn't been really seen before in Canada. And again, now we know, looking at other similar cases, we have, again, the toolbox to make sense of these, but they had absolutely no frame of reference at the time. So he ends up going to somebody almost straight out of, William Friedkin's The Exorcist, or the Blatty novel before that, like just out of desperation.
Wow. And how many serial killers were operating in London?
At least 9, 6 confirmed based on arrests, 1 identified posthumously through DNA. He was already dead and buried. They exhumed him. But at least another 3 who offended either twice in London, or I'm absolutely certain began in London and continued their crimes elsewhere. And at least 1 of these, or 2 of them, I'm sorry, 1 from 1968, 1 from 1956. So before actually this problem began. So this is sort of the bellwether murder that began the trend in 1956, the murder of a 6-year-old girl. Both have DNA and rich DNA samples, and they are prime candidates for genomics, or what we call genealogical forensics, in that since the DNA data bank, which is identical to the one in the US, we use the same software called CODIS. Since it went online in 99, 94 in the US, there's been no match, meaning that the offender has never been processed into the system to make a match to the crime scene samples. So this is where genomics comes in. Instead of looking at just convicted offenders, let's look at the entire population through their family trees. And I'm confident that both these cases can be solved, and my theory is proven correct pretty quickly if the police were so inclined.
And of these serial killers that were active during this time, I mean, all of their crimes are tragic and heinous, but were there ones that you were researching that just stood out as particularly depraved?
Well, they all are, but there's 3 sets that are particularly disturbing. One involves transportation of the victims for long distances post-mortem, and then elaborately concealing their bodies, which is correlated strongly with sadism. There's a great deal of satisfaction that the offender gets from depriving the family of an answer and a burial. He likely went back there and looked upon his work. And at least 1 case, it looks like he took a trophy in the way of her arm, and returns to the crime scenes in many cases to leave shrines at the crime scenes or taunts the family. So that's 1 set. There's another set involving the murder of young boys, where there's, a very ritualistic. These are the ones that the detective consulted the professor about. There's a very ritualistic, and I'm not going to get into it, but something done in terms of they're being undressed and redressed and then buried in the water or disposed of in the water that clearly has some symbolism and is linked to at least 1 other crime elsewhere committed by a separate offender who's now out on parole. And so these 2 somehow concocted. It's not a coincidence. They were both around the same age. They both operated within an hour of each other. And there's some significance to what's being done to these victims that it's bothered me that I can never get an answer to it. And it may be something only that makes sense to these twisted freaks that do this. But at least it would be a start in terms of studying and analyzing these people.
So you're saying 2 killers had similar circumstances with their victims, and they also used the same water source, and you're saying you think those 2 killers somehow knew each other or were aware of each other's work?
Not only aware of each other's work, but what was done to, so the first 2 boys were killed in 1968. Well, the 1 offender was in prison. He had a life sentence for trying to kidnap and murder a teenage girl. He's paroled out, very quickly targets of a young boy. So now he's changed his preferred victim and does precisely the same thing that was done in 1968. That information was never made public. And as far as I know, post-1968, these two people never had contact. So the contact is pre-68, when they both perhaps had a common abuser, experienced or observed something that had an indelible effect on both of them. And then they went out and began offending separately, but using precisely the same, not only MO, but signature. So something unique and idiosyncratic that has an emotional or sexual as a source of excitement for the offender, but that has no value added to the crime itself. And so for two people to share that delusion, essentially, and not be operating in tandem, because we do know about 40% of serial sexual murders have an accessory, but they were either not alive or not in the same city or in jail and out of jail separately and never offended together, as far as we're aware. So the question is, what is the common origin of that ritual?
It's just sort of a side question out of curiosity. Do you write criminal profiles for law enforcement?
Yes and no, not officially for law enforcement. My group has been approached, obviously, by law enforcement as well as families. So, and this is sort of where the idea of the Homicide Victims Families Rights Act came into, or where I hatched it. And then the people at MAP had the same idea, essentially to provide analytical reports, letting them know if they're on the right track or not. So for law enforcement, your listeners might not know this, but this is a main difference, I guess, to rewind back to the beginning. In Canada, police operate autonomously, completely autonomously. They do not take direction from our equivalent of the district attorney, who is an appointed prosecutor. They are not elected. They take an arm's length approach to police investigations. Once charges are laid, they ultimately decide whether or not, you know, they're going to move forward with this. They're going to action this out for a plea deal, the position they're going to take, so that they are not seen as directing the police. In the U.S., there is a much more of a hand-in-glove relationship, particularly in some municipalities. So we'll field requests sometimes to review confidential packages, basically prepared by police to present to the filing DA, basically. But so they want to charge someone with multiple murders. They can't just do that and hope for the best. They would need to consult with the district attorney, who decides at his or her discretion whether or not these charges are merited at this time. And we'll basically provide peer review for the quality of their work and whether or not their proposed linkages make sense based on the literature and based on other cases. And in the case of families, often we'll produce reports, and this is in my latest book, How to Solve a Cold Case, that they can bring actually to coroners or to medical examiners to lobby them to reopen cases closed either as accidents, suicides, or undetermined deaths, basically, whereby we'll say, based on the preponderance of evidence and these peer-reviewed studies, this should be deemed to be foul play until proven otherwise. And a snap judgment was made 10 years ago, and the family's been trying to get answers, and they don't want through police. So let's work around that and go directly to the people who maintain death records, which are coroners, quite frankly. And in the United States, Centers for Disease Control, which obtains mortality data on every individual living in the United States. And when we compare those to police records of homicides, like I mentioned, there's a shortfall of around 2,500 to 3,000 annually, and the records never get married up. It's not as though a body goes for an autopsy and it's been already ruled an accident. The medical examiner or the pathologist, days later, when wounds materialize because of the way the blood settles in the body, realizes, oh, in fact, this is suspicious and needs to be coded as a homicide. They don't get on the phone to the police department and say, you need to reopen this as a homicide. They file with the CDC, the police file with the Justice Department, and never do the two records meet again, other than through us at MAP.
Wow. Did you say that 40% of serial killers have an accomplice?
Approximately. Yeah, this has been well studied by a mentor of mine named Dr. Eric Hickey, who, if you've seen the Dahmer series, the Jeffrey Dahmer series on Netflix, they'll talk at the end about his brain being in the custody of faculty at CSU Fresno. He is the one who had custody of the brain and conducted many, many interviews with Dahmer. We learned a great deal about homicidal necrophiles from those interviews. to the extent that we catch them faster now, and those interviews have probably saved lives. So he studied rigorously the practices and associations among serial offenders, and we see that somewhere between 3 and 4 in 10 during at least one of their crimes have a direct accessory, whether it be a lure to draw in children or other women, someone who helps them to dispose of the body, or someone who partakes in the actual crime, not necessarily the primary crime scene or the abduction, but certainly once the victim is confined, that they're prepared to commit these atrocities as well. And they're broken down. He's even broken them down by relationships. So male-led teens, what's the nature of the relationship? Cousins, co-workers, nephews and uncles, female dominant teens, which are more rare, but this would be sort of your Murders on the Moor scenario with Myra Hindley and Ian Moore, or arguably Carla Homolka and Paul Bernardo here in Canada, which is a more recent case. But he's broken them down demographically and in terms of the interpersonal dynamics of the relationship. It's quite fascinating.
Wow. And is that willing participants only?
Precisely. Or again, presumptive data that can be gleaned. So information deemed reliable based on court records. So if someone says, provides state's evidence and pleads guilty and sends their accomplice up the river, you don't necessarily need an in-depth interview with them. The nature of the relationship has been established, and the nature of their collusion has been established on record in court.
It's a bit unnerving to think about those statistics.
Well, it is. And the question is, how do these people find each other? And especially if you have a very disturbed set of proclivities, for you to just raise this with somebody. I mean, a lot of these unfortunately materialize organically during, again, abusive dysfunctional relationships between, again, males and females. And ultimately, they figure out that they have sort of the same sadistic verve. The toolbox killers, I mean, there's an example of two sadistic sexual psychopaths who happen to meet in prison in the joint. And I mean, it's just bad fate, I guess, because ultimately their decision then is, once they both get out, they're going to reconnect on the outside. This is pre-internet. And then, as their moniker denotes, committed just absolutely horrible things to people. You have to ask yourself, now in a digital age, how much easier is it for these people to connect?
Yeah, seriously. That is a terrifying thought, no doubt. We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsor.
Step into the hidden corridors of the past with Hometown History, where every episode uncovers the untold stories and secrets nestled in the streets and alleys of our own backyards. We bring history to life, revealing the extraordinary in the ordinary, from local legends to forgotten tales that shape the communities we know today. Tune into Hometown History and embark on a journey through time, right from where you are. Gather round, friend, and join me by the fire. I have a secret to share. When I was a child, I lived with my grandma. She allowed me to watch Unsolved Mysteries. Fast forward to 2008, my freshman year of college. A series of armed robberies on campus escalated into a serial rapist's reign of terror. That's when I created my first crime podcast. In January 2014, I picked up the podcast again from my college roommate who fell for an underage girl online, to the chilling story of a murdered nun in 1969 Baltimore, and in the Throwaway series, I share my own journey of overcoming homelessness and how that experience led me to unmask a serial killer and identify three of his Jane Doe victims. This is Foul Play Crime Series, where the stories are real and the truth is waiting to be discovered.
How's it going, everyone? It's Tim and Lance here. Have you ever wanted someone to read you creepy bedtime stories in the most velvety voice ever?
Well, you had me hooked at velvety, Tim. We are excited to share a podcast that is exactly that. It's called Nighty Night Bedtime Stories to Keep You Awake. And Tim, it's narrated by a friend of ours.
That's right. New York Times bestselling author and podcaster, Rabia Chaudhry. Nighty Night is an anthology featuring classic horror stories this season and fictionalized true life stories in season one that are so creepy that you will realize reality is scarier than fiction.
And Tim, I know our favorite part of each episode is at the end when Rabia says, "But wait, there's more to the story." And we get to hear those fascinating details about the author and the context of the tale. What's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode is The Tiny Hares from season one, which takes us on a harrowing journey when the narrator runs into a dangerous man in the woods. What about you?
Well, mine comes from the current season. It's called The Horla, in which we witness the protagonist spiral into a descent of madness. Tim, I feel like I'm constantly spiraling into a descent of madness, so I really relate to that one.
Well, I hear that. So dim your lights, get under a cozy blanket, and find and subscribe to Nighty Night wherever you get your podcasts.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone. And a thank you to our sponsors. Back to the program.
And your newest book, How to Solve a Cold Case and Everything Else You Wanted to Know About Catching Killers. I'm listening to it now. It's excellent. In the intro, you mention a man who is you're related to, Samuel Gray. And then you started talking about the killer gene and wondering if that's something that you could have too. Could you tell us a little bit about this?
Well, I'm satisfied I don't, but certainly he likely did. And again, whether or not that's a recessive gene that eventually comes and goes depending on generations. I mean, there is, and this is to go back to Dahmer again, there is an improved understanding of the physiological and genetic hardwiring of people who commit these crimes. I mean, a lot of it is explained environmentally. As I explained in the book, many of these offenders had a certain common characteristics in their childhood that certainly had a formative effect on their willingness to commit these crimes and on a disordered relationship between intimacy and violence and humiliation. But there's also people who endured those conditions and don't commit these crimes. So I think we're looking at a little bit of column A, column B. The interesting story about Sam Gray is that, again, if you want to talk about genes, I mean, a few generations later, I'm descended from this person and I'm doing exactly the opposite. And I'm using whatever inherited knowledge there may be. We only understand, just getting to understand the true nature of acquired and inherited knowledge now, but I'm using it to try to catch these people and to help law enforcement catch these people. So it's just an interesting, ironic twist. And then was a sort of a jump off point to, in that introduction section, a bunch of interesting stories that you wouldn't think are connected. But that sort of is the nature of the book, is a series of vignettes connected in terms of letting people know that everything they think they know, I think, about this stuff has largely been misguided.
And to circle back on London, Ontario, I guess a two-part question. That must really do something to the makeup and the fabric of that community. And I'm curious how they're doing today. And also, have you taken those attributes from London, Ontario, and seen them in other places that could have potential nowadays to be a serial killer capital or hotspot?
Yeah. So again, I mentioned this in Murder City. I look at, actually, for comparative purposes, some other U.S. consumer test market cities. And again, weird, it could be coincidence. It's not, I mean, purely scientific. You would need to take every single one and, I mean, years of work. But just superficially, you look at other consumer test market cities, on the surface, unreliable, not marquee cities, but that are deemed significant by demographers and advertisers and marketers. And again, really weird trends, including well-known serial killers. And these municipalities have certain common characteristics. Let's just say that. That doesn't mean that they're necessarily causal, these underlying, again, demographic, socioeconomic issues, but there's certainly some common characteristics that suggest they have certain things in common. Now, London today obviously has a whole different set of problems, not unlike what you see on the evening news every night. It's an older city. that Great Lakes, a city that has been ravaged by addiction and homelessness and depopulation, and at the same time, repopulation with people who are just continuing and perpetuating what the earlier issue was. Horizontal urban sprawl, writ large, interior areas, historical areas, marginalized areas left to cave in to the extent that, I mean, I don't know what a prosperous future looks like for much of the city. The one good thing to come out of this period, and again, it's a sign of the times that it's now extinct because a combination of indifference and apathy and I guess technology, but you must have some version of this in the US, but in Canada, it's known as the Block Parent Program. And by the late 60s, these murders of children had become so prevalent, stranger abductions that are incredibly rare statistically, but in London were stock in trade, it seems, on a weekly basis, either near misses. I get emails from people who grew up during this period all the time, near misses, attempted abductions. Again, many of which weren't reported because the parents didn't want, you know, didn't want a police cruiser at the house taking a report. So that'd be embarrassing. So better let that person continue to operate in your neighborhood. So Block Parent was a program whereby a group of basically a local service club or a group of local service clubs designed these placards that could be put in the bay window of each house. And if you as a child were being followed, that sign denoted that there was a parent home, given the time, typically the wife or the mother of the house at home in the day, and you could run there and make unannounced entry to seek sanctuary in that house if you were being followed by somebody or someone was trying to get you. So by the 70s, this almost becomes a status symbol whereby the homemaker has this sign in a window and is a port in a storm for children being preyed upon. And it seems to have worked because these offenders obviously continued to operate, but the number of snatchings on the street of children seemed to drop off. And we'll never know because it wasn't rigorously studied. And you can't quantify the number of crimes prevented, but it seems to have certainly at least allowed the community to galvanize, recognize there was a problem, and allow neighbors to start talking to each other again.
I have no idea. Do you have any idea, Tim, if something like that exists here?
No.
That's remarkable. So did I hear that right? So you can put a little notification in your window, and if you're a child and you feel like you're in danger, that can be a safe haven.
Yep. So schools would train children as part of, again, you get your school bus safety training, you get your don't talk to strangers training. They're trained as this is the sign to look for. And I mean, when I was a cop, this was still a big thing to the extent that there was a police officer's job, full-time job, was assigned to screening applicants to B-block parents. Because they would have to go to the house, make sure, okay, is this place actually suitable for one or more kids to seek refuge here? Who else lives here? Obviously, your standard criminal record check, fingerprint checks, credit checks, stuff like that. But there's enough people interested in this program that was a full-time job, was just managing and administering the program. And it was, I mean, a tremendous grassroots crime prevention and outreach program. And I'm ballparking here, but I want to say by 2011, it was maybe 2014. Because while researching the book in 2014, I was still able to access their archives. So they were still semi-operational, but as of 2015, 2016, defunct. No one interested in doing this stuff anymore. And, you know, do you really need to run to somebody's house when, you know, you've got a smartphone by age 9 and you can just call 911 or take their photo? So sign of the times.
Yeah, I can see that. I feel like it also has this maybe had this unintentional community building to it as well.
Well, it did, to the extent that people wanted into the program and saw its value. And like I said, it had a certain, not that this was, I think, the motive of the original people, but it had a certain, sort of like being your neighborhood watch leader, I guess. It sort of put you, it situated you sort of as the voice of authority or as a role model on your block. And I mean, that kind of social capital in suburbia goes a long way. Not to, again, be cynical about why this program started, but you can see how it grows legs and it becomes something more than just an acute public safety initiative, which is how it began under obviously emergency circumstances.
Well, what's next, Michael? What's your next book about?
Good question. I'm going to let the tide wash over on this latest one. That was writing that during the pandemic and going through the editing process during the pandemic was difficult. The conclusion, the epilogue, deals with the new face of crime post-pandemic. And if anything, if there's anything I'm motivated to write now, it's probably a book on that. And that's going to take some time to begin researching or continue researching. I mean, I've got some ideas, but I'm going to have to, I mean, starting with the murder rate in 2020. So sky-high homicides in cities that saw 30 years of progress become undone in a matter of months. And the lowest national clearance rate since reliable statistics on this started being kept in 1929.
Well, when that book is ready to be promoted, you are more than welcome to come on to talk about it. And I absolutely love the fact that we can work in this industry and know people like yourself who is so passionate about trying to do the right thing and close these loopholes and tie up the loose ends and bring some sort of closure. But what's equally refreshing to me is how much science you put into it, how much of a effort you put into saying, here are the statistics and here's why this happens. And here's, you know, going way back now, here's how, you know, this thing started this. And getting that history is, I feel, really important for the listener, because it's not just something that happens in a vacuum in one place. There's a genuine reason why these crimes happen. And if you can get close to that answer, you can get close to maybe preventing them in the future. So it comforts me to know that you exist in this world.
Well, thanks. And on the topic of statistics, again, statistics are a double-edged sword. They can be they should be taken with a grain of salt sometimes. I mean, and that's, again, where we come along to try to close the loop or tie up loose ends, because they can be misleading. I saw somebody, some charlatan on the news the other day saying, you know, this is all propaganda about that crime is out of control in America. And in fact, last year there was, you know, or in these 10 cities, there's fewer murders than there have been recorded in the last 20 years. Okay, well, why those 10 cities? Why were those 10 cities cherry picked? Number two, we know that 60% of police departments, if you're relying strictly on FBI data, don't report to the FBI. UCR is a voluntary program. So you should be going to murderdata.org to get your real numbers, because everything else is largely a forecast of not a historical weather record. It's a forecast of the approximate number of murders. And then we still know that it's not accurate, because none of these federal agencies have ever reported their murders back to each other. And we've got two agencies saying, and I won't name them, but let's just say the two most mythologized federal agencies on television, who say they can't tell us how many murders they've had because they're still on paper. And in the one case, their records management system, which is based in DOS, you can't search by case type. So unless you have a specific file number you want to call up, like an old school library Dewey Decimal system, they can't just browse for murders in 2020 and hand us over a total. So we'll probably never know. So if you're hearing statistics, I would say be wary of your source that's on this topic. That's the only caveat I would add there.
Cool. Yeah, absolutely. Good point.
Good. Well, thank you so much, Mike, for spending some time with us here today. We are a bit smarter now, and we really appreciate your time and work.
All right, guys. Thanks for having me on, and good luck with the program. We'll see you again soon.